Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. Is getting to the middle part of this range retreat. So this is always a juicy part, a part where some people get a bit frustrated, other people go well. And of course, part of getting the meditation deeper is having these instructions and hopefully being inspired. It's very difficult to always say new things about meditation, but I still keep on that one subject, on how to be peaceful, how to overcome the hindrances, how to get a mind which is very mindful and poised, so it can become still, enjoy the bliss of meditation, understand where that bliss comes from, where we get deep insights, understand why we're not still, get insights into craving and the outflowings. So this big package, which is the almost like from the scientific background, the experiment of meditation. The experiment is to incline the mind towards peace and stillness. And when it works, why it works, how it feels. When it doesn't work, why it doesn't work. And this is where we find out all of the teachings of the Buddha. Very briefly, you know that I say about the two types of meditation, second noble truth meditation and third noble truth meditation. I just put this out at the very beginning, you've heard it before, but it's always a great teaching. Second noble truth, in brief, craving leads to suffering. The third noble truth, in brief, letting go leads to the end of suffering, which is happiness. So if you are suffering with your meditation, if it's not working, it's not giving you peace and comfort, if it's causing you suffering in all its different manifestations, that means you've been doing second noble truth meditation, you've been craving. That's why they're suffering. It's very brilliant teaching, it's simple, but it means you understand what you've been doing. So you get the insight that you've been following a path which the Buddha said is going to lead to suffering. You've been craving, wanting, expecting something. And every time you have a beautiful meditation, you're comfortable, peaceful, delightful, you know that must be third noble truth meditation, you've been letting go of something. And it's really important to be able to notice something simple like that, a little framework to understanding your meditations, so that you understand the second and third noble truth. You understand what letting go really is. You get the insight through the experience of letting go, through kaya pati sangvedi, experiencing it with your own body, which of course Ajahn Brahmadi knows, as we all should know now, it's nothing to do with your physical body, it means the personal experience of these states. You personally experience letting go, and you personally experience the result of letting go, which is the peace and bliss of the mind. So what that actually does, that gives you confidence and faith in these Buddha's teachings. And it brings me on to the, sort of the first factor of what I wanted to talk about this evening, about the five indriyas and how they empower the meditation, especially at this time. Sometimes we need to give it a boost. Now, some of you might get a bit bored. What happens usually in any endeavor when we first do something, it's new, it's fresh, so it can give it all this sort of energy. It's the energy of freshness, of youth, of new things. You know what Suzuki Roshi, the quote from Zen, don't do that very often, so that should perk you up, said, you know, the beginner's mind. You know, he made a good point there, the beginner's mind, and when you look at something afresh, it's interesting, it's new, you get energy, you can actually apply the mind to new things, but when it's another meditation, another day, after the beginning of a long retreat, many weeks have gone past, sometimes there's a sense of like boredom comes in. Here we go again, another day, another sort of meditation. And sometimes we do at this particular stage need to sort of give our meditation a boost. And of course the sadhā is very close to what I say is like the inspiration. You know, faith in sort of the Buddha's teachings or confidence which inspires you The most important thing is the confidence it's possible. It was really weird when I was a young monk. You know, you sort of heard all these tales, especially from places like Sri Lanka, that it's not possible to be enlightened anymore. Or, you know, you hear these other sort of ideas that sort of women can't become enlightened. Or sort of, you know, Westerners, they're hopeless. Maybe, you know, if you're born in Northeast Thailand, you can become enlightened, but Westerners, no way. You hear all these amazing, you know, stupid statements. But of course what happens is that even though they're stupid statements, if they're repeated often enough, people tend to believe them. They start to doubt themselves. Even recently, just somebody came up to talk to me and just, you know, was asking, you know, can we really become enlightened these days? I said, of course you can. And it's amazing to actually just to know that, to have the faith that it's possible. Because look, if you think it's impossible, or if you think you can't do it, if you think somehow or other there's something missing in you, or some insurmountable impediment, of course you won't even have the inclination to achieve. And it's part of the job of the teacher, look through the sutras yourself if you wish, to know that it is possible. And I always like recalling the advice, or the little passage from the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, where the Buddha said, as long as there's people practicing the Eightfold Path, they'll be found in this world, stream winners, once returners, non-returners and arahats. So it's nothing to do with you, it's whether you're practicing the Eightfold Path or not. It just resonates with this whole idea of non-self. You know, it's not up to you whether you know you think you can or you can't, whether you have abilities or haven't got abilities. That's all self stuff. It's just whether you practice. If you put those courses into place, those are the effects. And of course, I've been a monk such a long time now that you know you actually see it actually works. And hopefully that many of you have been maybe in this monastery long enough now to see progress happening, to see it does work, to see that if you do practice the Third Noble Truth meditation, you do get peaceful. If you practice the Second Noble Truth, you stuff up the mind. So you start to get faith in these teachings, and you start to have faith in the teachings of the Buddha. And that gives you the confidence, the inspiration to actually to go further. It's the faith in the path and the faith that you can do it. The faith that you can do it is also really important. That's why that sometimes that particular type of faith can turn into a hindrance. You know, when you get some sort of results from the meditation, you're going into meditation, you see sort of a nimitta for the first time, or you really get some bliss for the first time, you get excited, you think, wow, it's actually true, I can do this. And of course, it's a wonderful thing to actually to know that, yes, even me, I can do this. And that sort of sometimes makes you excited, and really that sort of particular hindrance of excitement, yeah, it sort of stops you proceeding, but and it's a sweet hindrance. You know, in the sense that, okay, you know, well done, you know, you've got somewhere. You know, it gives you more faith in the future. That's why it's, you know, sweet. It stops you for the time being, but it might motivate you in the future. And it's that motivation to actually to keep on getting on that cushion or that chair or that stool, to keep on the walking path. Because it's true, you know, with that persistence, you know, there's always that success. And a lot of times, in all many, many aspects of life, it's people who don't persist. You know, people who just, you know, they get a bit frustrated and they just give up. And to me, that's really stupid. Because if you, you know, you don't get success and you give up, you know, number one, why? It's nothing to do with you. It's no fault in you. It means, you know, you're not following the path properly. You're doing, say, Second Noble Truth meditation. You know, you're not sort of understanding the causes of samadhi or the causes of peace. So number one, don't just give up. Investigate why. And also keep persisting. Because after a while, if you keep on going, keep on going, keep on going, keep on going, your mind will become still. It's the cause and effect. Even those people who think they're not good meditators, if they put in the hours and consistency, of course you get still and peaceful. Because look, why? It's because, you know, even if you're sitting down there with sloth and torpor, at least you're not sort of indulging in this restlessness of the mind which goes searching for sensory objects. That's why I keep on saying that restlessness is not that bad a hindrance. It's the other ones, the restlessness, getting into fantasies, planning and wasting time. That activity of the mind, that sort of takes away the energy, which is much, much worse than sloth and torpor. So at least if you're restraining the mind, it means you're building up your store of peace, you know, the peace karma. It just builds and builds and builds and builds until finally you are peaceful. It's just cause and effect, that's just the way it happens. So you usually find if you keep on just sitting, and even if it's not getting where you want it to get, maybe you're a bit bored or you're a bit dull, keep on sitting down there. And you just build up and build up and build up until eventually it does sort of break through into sort of this beautiful mindfulness and clarity. Because this is one of the problems with the that sort of persistence there, you might sort of call it even part of the second of the indriyas, the virya. And sometimes, you know, you've heard me say this before, and you know, it seems to be valid that, you know, virya is connected to vira, the hero, and it's more like a heroic effort. I like the word heroic effort because, you know, once you made that connection, once I made that connection, something to do with a hero, who is a hero? And the way it was used, you know, in those days in ancient India was the sort of the person who went into battle, or the elephant who would just not protect any part of its body. So it would totally let go and give its whole body, give itself into wounding or being killed, you know, for the cause of the king. And that degree of heroism always came with this self-sacrifice, with this letting go, not concern about you being able to give everything, even your whole life, for something. And it was that degree of letting go, of sacrifice, of surrender, of giving up for a cause, which I made that connection with that particular type of energy, which is virya, which is part of the indriyas, these spiritual powers. Because to me, the other type of virya, you know, the virya of the athletes. Because I remember reading these articles about some of these athletes, these elite athletes, and just the amount of time they train. And just the way they just, you know, they can't eat what they want. They can't have condensed milk and their tea in the morning because their trainer won't let them. And they have to sort of give up so much. And so, so much energy, but, you know, it's for personal gain. And it's, you know, the wrong type of virya. Yeah, you can just see the great effort. And you can see other people. I've seen so many people just in meditation retreats or in monasteries in my life who just get in there and they just push and push and they hardly sleep. And they just don't get anywhere. Because it's not virya. Yeah, it's effort and energy, but it's not coming with this surrender, which is selflessness. It's always the energy from wanting something. That's a totally different type, and it's not a spiritual power anymore. It's, you know, what they call spiritual materialism. Huge amount of energy and effort, but to get something. You know, for the self to become even more attained and more sort of superior than other people. And now that's not the virya which I understand. The virya which I understand is the ability to totally surrender, to let go, to give up, to be able to sit there and just, you know, wait in the moment, just even though it's unpleasant. It's the energy to sacrifice, to give up, to endure, to let things be, not to get things. It's heroic to do that. It's very simple for people, you know, if you tell them, okay, if you meditate for an hour, you get a certificate. If you meditate for 3 days or 7 days, then you can give you a Sotapanna certificate or whatever. If you get something out of it, it's pretty easy to do. But the idea of actually meditating, not getting anything out of it, that's virya. And to put energy into doing that, not wanting anything, but see how much you can let go. Now that is an enormous spiritual power. And that's why, and it's part of the causes which really boost your meditation and take it to a powerful, deep level. You know, the vira, the hero, the one who gives his whole life, who can charge into battle knowing it's going to be killed and destroyed, or at least willing for that to happen, not protecting any part of itself, like the elephant going into battle. So you meditate, not protecting any part of yourself, especially any part of your pride, hope to achieve, who you think you are, to be able to abandon all parts of yourself. And that's a heroic effort. And of course, this is not an effort where you screw down your will and sort of increase its intensity. That again is the error which many monks have made. I've seen myself make that. To screw down, right, this is it, I'm going to become enlightened no matter what. Now, I was fortunate, you know that old story when I was very young, that this was, I can tell you now, it was when I was 18 years of age, a long time ago. I don't think this was in my book, you should have put this in the book, Ajahn Brahmaya. It's a really good story, that once when I went to my very first Waisak ceremony. And I still remember it was Dr. Sadatissa, who was quite a famous monk. He was the abbot of the London Buddhist Vihara in those days. And he came up to do the ceremony for our students in Cambridge. And you know, even though he wasn't the best speaker, but you know, the story was very good. My first Waisak really inspired. So what did I do? Went back to my room to become enlightened. I did. You heard that the Buddha made that adhitana, that resolution. Even though my bones turn to dust and my blood dries up, I will not move from this seat until I get full enlightenment. You know, and of course, you know, you're stupid as a young man. And that's what I did. I really did this. I went back to my room, got my cushion out, sat down, and quite seriously, I wasn't joking. Even though my bones turn to dust, my blood dries up, I'm not going to move from this cushion. Even if I miss my lectures tomorrow morning, I'm not going to move. And I lasted about 45 minutes, which broke my record. And 20 minutes was, I think, how long I usually meditated for. And you know, after 45 minutes, I was in absolute agony. You know, you know what it's like when you sort of sit there, you endure, trying to use willpower. And of course, you know, my blood was still flowing, my bones were still solid, they hadn't turned to dust, I was not enlightened at all. But you know, those experiences like that show me the futility of willpower. And I did have willpower. I really squeezed, you know, an extra twice as long as I usually meditate, going through a lot of pain. But where did it get you? Absolutely nowhere. It wasn't heroic effort. It was just willpower. Coming from a place of stupidity and ignorance and delusion. But it's the ability to let go. That is energy. And of course you've heard me sort of talk about the power which comes when you start letting go. And that to me is just a beautiful thing to see, that when you do sort of, you know, have a bit of inspiration and you do put in the hours and you do let go, the energy comes by itself, this power, which to me is, you know, what mindfulness really means. It's the power mindfulness is, where you're sitting there and you can actually see what's going on. So you know what it's like, even today I was meditating and there's just a bit all over the place, because my mindfulness was a bit dull. And it took a while before the mindfulness got clear. And once the mindfulness was clear and powerful, you could see exactly what's going on in your mind, and you could, you know, sort of stop doing this and stop doing that and get some nice samadhi coming up. But you know, you didn't need that sort of degree of powerful mindfulness. It's just like being able to see. It's just like rubbing your eyes when you first get up in the morning, and you know, first of all you can't see very much and now you can. And just as those eyes get brighter and brighter and you get clearer and clearer, you can see more and more. That's the sort of the mindfulness which you need in meditation. And it's that energetic mindfulness. By energetic, I don't mean being restless, going all over the place, but powerful mindfulness, so you can see deeply. I know it's a tough one, because, you know, once you've got powerful mindfulness, you can create more power. But when you haven't got powerful mindfulness, where you don't know what it's doing, it's very tough to actually to get that powerful mindfulness in the first place. Once you do it, your meditation's easy. You're off. But it's like getting we might call the minimum level of mindfulness to be really able to meditate, to to arouse that level is a tough one. Once you can do it, then you have great meditations. But before then, you don't know what you're doing, you get a bit lost, you get a bit frustrated, you get tired, you get bored, nothing is working because the mindfulness isn't strong enough and powerful enough to be able to see the problems. You're just like walking through the forest in the dark without a flashlight. And you keep on bumping into the trees or falling over things. If you've got a strong flashlight, of course you can weave your way around the obstacles. You don't bump into things. It's getting that strong flashlight, that strong mindfulness, that's a difficulty. But to me, I've seen over many years of practice, to get that strong mindfulness, I do have to restrain the five hindrances. Sensory desire just wastes so much energy. You want this and you want that and you indulge in pleasures. That is a waste of energy. And that's why, what does it say, that in the Tayana Gata, Napahaya Muni Kame, Nekatamupa Pachati, if the sage, the meditator, if they can't overcome the five senses, they can't renounce them, give them away, abandon them, they can't achieve this oneness of mind, the samadhi. And we often think, why not? It's because the world of the five senses and sensory desire just consumes so much energy. It tires us out. That's why we have restraint. That's why we have solitude. That's why we have no TVs, no sort of entertainment. Because the entertainment just takes away your energy. That's one of the reasons why people meditate after indulging and they're dull. But if you do restrain yourself, just put yourself in your heart, spend as much time as possible in meditating, walking, sitting, or just being peaceful, and you get more energy up. And as that energy comes up, it's good energy, not restless energy, so it can go into mindfulness. You become more awake, more alert, meditation becomes easy. Now there is a very easy to see connection between sense restraint and mindfulness. Now once the sense restraint is there, the energy can go into the mind, your mindfulness can increase in power. And once that mindfulness is increasing power, that is an enormous boost to your meditation. Once you get that mindfulness, please preserve it, because if you waste it by thinking, oh, now I'm mindful, I can just relax a bit and just indulge, then you'll find that the mindfulness vanishes, you have to build it up again. Once the mindfulness is strong, it's just so nice to meditate, it's easy to meditate, you get joy out of it, you can actually get some peace and delight and nimittas and everything else. It's just getting that mindfulness up first of all. And of course once it's there, it's easy to do the samadhi, to become still. Why is that? Because you can see all the reasons why you agitate the mind. You can see just how you interfere with the mind. You can see that it's not that the mind sort of becomes agitated by itself. You stick your finger in there and make it happen. I told many people during their interviews the common sort of complaint they make. They say they're sitting there quite quietly and just thoughts come into their mind. And I used to think that until your mindfulness became very strong and very profound. When my mindfulness got to that very strong level, I could see what was happening. I was going out looking for thoughts and bringing them back home. And I was just... It was me, I was getting those thoughts in. They weren't coming by themselves. I was going outside and grabbing any old thought and bringing it into my consciousness. Mindfulness was strong enough to see that. And of course that shocked me. These weren't random thoughts. I had got them to come in. As soon as I saw that, it was actually quite a relief. Because if I was the one who did this, I could stop doing it. Because I could stop doing it, it meant no more random thoughts. You could actually cut them off simply by seeing that they weren't coming naturally, that I was responsible for them. If I was responsible for my stupidity, I could be wise, use that wisdom power, and they would stop. So it's just an example of just how mindfulness, when it does become strong, can see these tendencies of the mind which, you know, stop you being still. And of course that mindfulness gets stronger and stronger, and it needs to be that strong as you go deep in your meditation. Another simile which I use is like every level of meditation, you have another test. It's a test of your mindfulness and wisdom. To get past the next level, you have to be more mindful, in other words, more powerful mindfulness, see more, and have a little bit more wisdom. Because, you know, the deeper you go in meditation, the more subtle are these, you know, irritations and interference and agitations, you know, which, you know, you impose upon the mind. And it takes a while to see exactly what you're doing. Now, so you get sort of, you know, you're aware of the breath. Why can't you get piti-sukha up? Why? It is because you are still interfering, you're still doing things, you're still agitating the mind. It can't be still enough to get the beauty and the joy up. And all you can need to do is to see that. A lot of time it is maybe because you're expecting these things to come up. And you realize expecting, you're not in the present moment anymore. You're missing it. And when you can't focus, that was my little technique. There's no piti-sukha coming up. I would just, you know, perceive my mind like this camera, which was slightly out of focus. I just twist the lens slightly, just to make this focus really sharp. And you know, before I thought I was sharp enough. Yeah, I was sharp enough to see, but it wasn't really crisply sharp. And as soon as I got that refinement in my focus in the present moment, then all the joy would come up. Just that slight little bit of out of focus was my cause. And so you saw that with mindfulness, and you knew exactly what needed to be to happen. And of course you got the result in beautiful piti-sukha. Other times your mindfulness can see those little very refined expectations. You're getting close, especially if you've had experiences before, you're getting close, you know what's going to happen next, bring it on. And that's the trouble, you can't bring it on. Little inclinations like that into the future stops you achieving anything. Stops you realizing these things. Shouldn't said achieving, realizing them. And as you notice this, your mindfulness is strong enough to pick it up every time. And the mindfulness in this particular case does act like the bouncer, like the guard. It just stops these things. It just sees these stupid little idiosyncrasies of the mind, these defilements of this mind, these upakalesas, because they're very refined. It sees them and just stops them because it's powerful enough. So every stage, the mindfulness needs to be that more powerful to see the more refined problems. And not only does that show you the insights, the nature of these things called asavas, outflowings, cravings, and all these other graspings of the mind, you actually see them in action. These are the important ones. The coarse defilements, anyone can see those. But to see the refined ones, those are the ones which stop you becoming enlightened. The ones which you meet, you know, on the last gates before jhana. As you pass through those gates, of course you do experience this beautiful stillness of the mind. And of course the stillness reinforces, you know, the mindfulness. So the mindfulness and the stillness, especially, they sort of work together. And they build up this power of the mind. Now of course there's many types of power. There's a power which you have, like you get heaps of energy just after a meditation. Or heaps of energy just now after a good cup of coffee, or heaps of energy when something goes right and you're really delighted by some good news from home or something. Yeah, you get lots of energy, but that is a very restless and very agitated type of energy. And sort of energy you get at these stages of meditation, you know, there's the still energy. And it's just poised. It's like the energy of like a panther or a leopard, just all coiled up, but very, very still. Powerful, but poised. And to get those ideas of what this energy is like, it's not restless at all, it's all focused in a moment. It's focused in a point. Powerful, but still. That type of energy, you can understand, is the major cause of the big pity sukhas, the nimittas. The mind gets very, very empowered. And of course, as it becomes empowered, the mindfulness gets even stronger. And the stillness gets stronger. So you have these indriyas and they just build up. And once you have the mindfulness and the stillness, there you can get your wisdom, your panya, the last of the indriyas. Because it's true that we become enlightened, you know, through insight, through wisdom. But the point is, how do we get that wisdom? Where does it come from? And, you know, for many people it's from listening to talks, you know, and of course you can listen to hundreds of talks, there's just thousands out there, and of course you don't get that much wiser. And if somebody asks me, and they keep on asking, why is it that five monks listen to the same sutta which you just heard a few minutes ago, Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, and they all became arahats? And how many people here became an arahat this evening? And you know, you listen to exactly the same teaching. Why not? Because you don't just become enlightened through listening to teachings. It's just all that which went before. The teachings, you know, were just, as they say, the straw which broke the camel's back, the last piece of the jigsaw puzzle, the last little ingredient. It was just like the person who just shouted and the avalanche came. The avalanche of snow was perfectly poised. It just needed a slight trigger. And then this huge mass of snow came down the mountain. Just like that last little insight. And just the whole of samsara comes crashing down. There's another arahat. So it's what went before is really important. All the snow which fell on the mountain and built and built and built and built to this level of instability only needed just one more little teaching. And the whole of samsara came tumbling down. So this particular case, that wisdom faculty does not come just through thinking about things. That's, many people have thought much longer than I've thought. And they've got far greater intellects than I have. And they just know so much more information than I'll ever know. And they're stupid as hell. And sometimes, that's one of the reasons why I stopped academia. I knew that because you were with, like, you know, I knew a couple of Nobel laureates. And these are Nobel laureates. It's the master of the college, I think it was a Nobel laureate in chemistry. And these were, you know, high achievers. And their brains were just amazing. Some of the people, you know, their brains were just out of this world. You know, they were just intellectually just, you know, like aliens. But they were so stupid. And that was what really sort of shocked me. How was it that people had such a great intellect and enormous knowledge, encyclopedias, and walking Wikipedias, but they were just dumb. They just had all these emotional problems and social anxieties. So something really wrong there. I realized at that time that all this knowledge, that's not wisdom. You need something more. And that's the experience of stillness. That was actually what separated out Buddhism from so many other religions. Not a revealed religion, but an experienced truth coming from the deep stillness of the mind. And of course, this is what you develop. And the more you develop your meditation, the more you understand about the Dhamma. The more you understand about the Dhamma, the easier it is to meditate. And the deeper your meditation, the more you understand about things like non-self. As you understand about non-self, that wisdom, there's nobody here, what's the big deal? What am I trying to attain? There's no one to attain anything. How can I ever say I'm a streaming or a once returned or an arahat? Who's an arahat? Is my rupa kanda an arahat? My vedana, my sanya, sankara, is it vijnana? Is that an arahat? Is my eye consciousness enlightened? my mind consciousness, just the same? Is my nose enlightened? My taste enlightened? Because probably my taste buds are pretty enlightened because they appreciate the better things in life like mushy peas and condensed milk. Of course, see how stupid that is. So the more you see non-self, the easier it is to let go. That's why the panya becomes one of the spiritual powers. And the more you see suffering, dukkha, just this body and the five senses. How many times have you delighted in things of the five senses? You know, beautiful sights, beautiful girls, boys, whatever you like. Beautiful food. How many times have you eaten fish and chips? Kimchi, whatever else you like. How many times do you have to eat kimchi to become enlightened? And you see in the end that there's a certain sense of waste of time in this. The wisdom sees these five, and it's just a heavy burden. One of the nice things about getting into deep meditation, when your body disappears, when it really disappears, you don't want to come back to it, because when you come back to it, it's heavy. When you know what you're talking about, because you have experience of getting beyond the five senses, where you can't feel the body anymore, and you come back again, gee, this body is dukkha. You understand what dukkha means. It's just this heaviness, this burden of a body, always demanding your attention, always telling you what to do, take me to the toilet, scratch me. Give me some food, I need some water, I need to sort of move my body. It's just totally demanding. And once you've gone away from your body, you come back again, you realize just what a prison it is. It's not just an ordinary prison, it's worse than Guantanamo Bay. At least in Guantanamo Bay it gives you an opportunity to sleep every now and again. This body, even when you're sleeping, it just dreams, tossing and turning, trying to get a nice place to rest. And actually just seeing that this body in all of its manifestations is essentially a problem helps you let go. So a little bit of wisdom, understanding dukkha, understanding non-self, understanding, let's not call it impermanence, let's call it uncertainty. Ajahn Chah's great sort of description of anicca, it's so uncertain. That I was just joking with Ajahn Bhamali, I make all these promises to go here and go there. And look, it's dhamma, it's uncertain. I don't know what I'm going to do next. You have good intentions, to go to Norway every year, but come on, you're Buddhist. If the people in Norway don't understand anicca, I'm not going there anymore. So it's uncertain. Once you see that the uncertainty, that just gives you so much freedom. So you don't plan the future so much. I haven't got a clue what's going to happen in the future. You got some ideas, but always something else happens. Look, I had this great plan that the door, which for the teacher's cottage, was going to come last week, and today Rob was going to paint it. Not only was the door the wrong door, but the paintbrushes were the wrong paintbrushes. So much for all my plans. So, of course, that's just the outside life, but that's the same in my inside life as well. Sometimes I sit down and great, an afternoon, I can meditate. I'm going to do a nice, peaceful meditation. I'm going to give a talk this evening. So I'm going to have 3 or 4 hours, and somebody knocks on the door, or something happens. So, look, that's my life. So, when you understand that you can't plan anything, you can't even plan your own meditation. It's totally uncertain. What do? Got no choice. You let go. You don't plan anything. You don't expect anything. You don't ask for anything. You're free at last. And that becomes such a beautiful thing. When you have that degree of wisdom, of course, meditation is so easy. You're not asking for anything. So of course you never get disappointed. This body is suffering, this mind is suffering too, so if it doesn't work, there we go. I've just proved the Four Noble Truths. So I've had a wonderful afternoon, sort of realizing the First Noble Truth. What a great way of spending an afternoon. Well, if it does work, great, I've done second noble truth. No, third noble truth today. So remember, you've got to sort of investigate all the four noble truths, not just one of them. So you can share your time between the four. That's what happens. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. Totally uncertain, nothing to do with me. It also means that when you have a bad meditation, not a bad meditation, nothing to do with me, not my fault. It's just because, you know, you fed me the wrong food today, or you gave me too much, or, you know, you talked to me too much. You sort of stirred up my mind. It's your fault, not mine. It's great when you understand anatta. You can be totally irresponsible. It's great being an abbot who's irresponsible. Otherwise, I'd just go crazy with all you guys, all these interviews and all this responsibility and all this having to do this and do that. So no, realizing it's nothing to do with me. None of my business. That's my wonderful mantra. You know, when I get sort of too many things, you sit down there and you start meditating, then all this idea of responsibility, oh, I should be doing something, I should be writing that letter, I should be making that telephone call. Then in my mind comes, none of my business. I love that mantra. None of my business. So I can just let things go. That's using wisdom. It's not your business. It's not my business. So it's beautiful when you have those wisdom. It only comes from stillness, comes from mindfulness, comes from this heroic letting go energy of sacrificing, abandoning, surrendering, nothing to do with me. And from the faith that it can be done, you've been inspired. There's something, I don't know, there's something about these teachings of the Buddha. The first time I heard them, didn't understand them, but they smelt right. There's something about them which was going to incite some faith and confidence that this was a path which works. And of course, you know, that's the way I've been teaching for years. You're part of letting go of doing nothing. That's weird. But there's something about that which makes sense. Even though at first it seems a bit illogical, you become enlightened by just sitting there doing nothing, waiting for the mangoes to fall from the tree. As Ajahn Chah's simile said, seems illogical. There's something about it which resonates with truth. And that's the faith, the inspiration. And of course, you give it a try and it works. So, the big middle of the retreat. If, you know, you're getting a bit bored or dull or worrying, gee, how many more weeks, planning what you're going to do when the retreat's over and all that sort of ridiculous rubbish. Just have a look at those five indriyas. Give yourself a boost. Because these are the spiritual powers, and they call them spiritual powers or spiritual controlling faculties. I didn't like controlling, but, you know, spiritual energy boosts. If you're a bit dull, focus on those and see if you can use one or the other to really boost the meditation. To make you get up earlier, stay up later, put more time, you know, on the path or on the cushion. Because, you know, that's, as I said, really important. When people talk about effort, I've often made the point, the effort is to get on the cushion. The effort is to get on the path, and then you let go. Don't let go before you reach the cushion. That's what some people say. Oh, yeah, I woke up this morning. No, come on, let go, let go, let go. Meditating, that's desire. Yeah. And then you think, I'm being attacked by Mara. And then you think, who am I to defeat Mara? I'm an ordinary guy. I would be conceited to think that I can defeat Mara, so just turn over and have a snooze. Now that's not letting go, that's indulging. So once you get to the cushion, once you get on the path, then you can let go, but not before. And as soon as you're on the cushion, stay there. Don't think, I've got to let go of the cushion now. 5 minutes, that's enough. Middle way. Now get the energies up. Get the sort of the faith, the confidence. It's really worth doing. But what's the alternative? You know what it's like to have a restless mind, have a mind which is subject to getting angry when you don't get your own way, or somebody says something or does something which upsets you. It's really painful getting angry. It's just like a disease, you know, like getting a cancer. No one wants to get a cancer. It's like getting bitten by a snake. No one wants to get bitten by a snake or a red-back spider. You avoid those things. That's why you avoid this anger and ill will and other defilements. Yeah, desire and lust, yeah, you have a bit of fun for a few minutes, but you pay for it afterwards. It just saps your energy. You get dull. It's really worthwhile restraining. So, you know, you get that understanding, that wisdom, and it means you, you know, you become a really good meditator. When you become a good meditator, you enjoy this place, you belong here, which means you're not taking up the place where someone else could make a much better job than you're doing. You belong here, you're a meditator, you have fun, you make me very happy. And the irresponsible abbot can be even more irresponsible when, you know, you're having a good time. It means I can have a good time. It means that you're on the path, you're getting there. And all these five indriyas, they empower your meditation. So if it's not working, have a boost of vitamin I, vitamin indriya, which really gets you going. So that's the little talk this evening on boosting your meditation with the five indriyas. Good. Bhagavato Sāvaka Sangho.